Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in-store or online at harrycurry.com. Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. I hear Harry Curry saying, put a spring in your step. Debbie, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe, how are
you? Oh, you're on WhatsApp, That's why I don't see you on the screen. Okay, I was saying, put a spring in your step, but you're an athlete, and you find...
Yes, I am.
After you put a spring in your step for a long distance, what happens?
It's not even a long distance, Joe. It's at any distance when I'm racing. So I would consider myself very fit. I'd have a set training plan, have a great coach called Bill Porter. But just when I'm racing, not when I'm training or doing long runs or any of that kind of thing, during the race, I would have this nausea come over me and I would nearly throw up at the finish line of every single race. I have had various tests done in the hospital. First of all, before anyone rings in, it's not nerves. I'm not nervous. I'm well used to racing. Like, I'd participate in probably one official race a month.
And you've represented Ireland internationally, I see.
I have.
Yeah, okay. So
I'm doing everything right nutrition-wise. Like, as I said, I went to the hospital. They put a camera down my stomach.
They did a scan.
They had a biopsy. I've been on pantoprazole stomach tablets. I've tried alternative medicine. Nothing works. So I absolutely love what I'm doing. I love running. I love racing. I love the buzz of it. But I'd love to try and sort out what is going on with my stomach, because it lets me down every race.
But hang on, you do vomit.
Yeah.
Okay. I know it's a bit difficult
most
to hear
of the
this
time.
Type. Okay.
I know.
But it happens after the race.
During the race sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'd be retching, like trying not to get sick, if you know what I mean. But I would never give up. I would always finish the race.
How do you know it's not... Okay, you say it's not physically. You've done all the scans and the endoscopy and the colonoscopy and the cameras, everything. And it's not your stomach. It's not physical. So then
It's higher up in my stomach, if you know what I mean.
But surely if it's not physical, it has to be psychological.
I'm very calm and collected and I love the race. It's to my knowledge, is going through my head negatively because I get such a buzz from it. And the endorphins that get released when I'm running are happy endorphins. I won't rule it out. I'm open to any suggestions, but
I'm just thinking of actors. I'm reading it at the minute. It's a great book by PJ Gallagher, He's a presenter on Nova, and he's also...
People know
him naked. He's brilliant. It's a brilliant book, by the way. It's called Madhouse.
I have it.
Well, then, if you open the centre pages, open it, but the photographs, you'd see PJ. You won't see him actually puking, but you'll see PJ after a show, and he's bent over on a chair, and he says his nerves do be gone, as the fella said, and he does be vomiting. So it's not unusual for performers.
Yeah, I know. I did read that part, I'm sure I heard with different comedians as well. Like, they all get that kind of nerves.
Well, have you come across other runners who there's no physical reason for them to throw up, but they do? And they say it's not nerves. You're adamant it's not nerves.
Well, I don't feel it is. Definitely don't feel nervous. I'm well used to running. I've run hundreds of races. So it's just a part of my week nearly sometimes. So I'd love to know, has anyone else experienced this? And did they get help or what? Do they get something to help them or something that I've missed?
We'll come at a different direction, pardon the pun. Does it affect your running?
Yes. Like, I could go faster. Like, I'm lucky that I normally would win a category prize nearly every race and a lot of the time team medals. But I know I can even do better than that. It definitely takes for my performance. So that's where I put in all the hard work during the week.
Okay.
I have a set training plan. I do everything right. I eat healthy. I race week. I'll back off and I'll have an easier week and I'll eat all the right foods. Everything is regimental. Rest, go to bed at a certain time. And everything is routine.
Monday is your day off. Tuesday is your interval training. Wednesday, an easier run. Thursday, an interval run at 12K. No messing. Friday, a day off. Saturday, 25K. Sunday, 12K. Sure, even the thought of that would have me thrown up. No, I'm not trying to be facetious, but it is a lot.
Over time, you know, anyone can do it if I can do it. You know, I started off literally doing the couch to 5K. In 2012, I never started running until I was in my 40s. And a friend of mine, Karina, asked me what I do, the Great Ireland Run. Had never run before, was never athletic in school. And we did the couch to 5K and I loved it from the very word go. And I never stopped.
And how many years are you running now then? If you took it up at 40?
2012. So since 2012.
Wow.
And I never... Yeah.
So is it fair? Like, is it fair to say you're in your early 50s?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually 58 at the end of the month. Yeah. And that's what I love about athletics is your age doesn't normately come into it.
Yeah,
like the club I run in Parnell, we have a range of people from 15 to 75, all in our athletics club, all run competitively. Yeah. And you know, with GA, you hang up your boots at a certain age or different sports. The good thing about athletics is there's a place there for everybody.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's such a lovely social side as well. I've met the best of friends. Like, they're like my running family.
Well, have you said it to any of them?
Yes.
To anyone else?
That's how I ended up contacting your show, Joe, because a friend just asked me there the other night, how did I get on with the jailbreak in Wicklow there a few weeks ago? And I said, well, you know, not too bad. I won my age category. And then my coach interrupts him and goes, Debbie was so sick again. And Tony said, you know what, Debbie, I'd love to do something to help you. Leave it with me. So then he texts me the other night and he said, Debbie, why don't you get in contact with Joe Duffy? Put it out there and see if anyone can help you or has anyone experienced this? Or so I'm literally just, I'd love if someone came along to me and said, look, this is what it is. You're allergic to this. It's this, that, or the other. I do anything just to stop this or to help it. I'm open to anything, you know, at this stage. I'd love it to be not a part of my run and just to go out
But somebody is, so I'm just reading a text has come in. Somebody said, Adele, now the only Adele in my life is Twink. But apparently the Adele that's being referred to as Adele, you know, hello. Hello, is it me you're looking for?
Yeah.
Apparently she, unfortunately, she says she vomits quite a lot. And this is a quote, quite a lot before going on stage, though obviously never actually on the stage.
Right.
But before, Adele, who was, anyway, Sarah, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe, good afternoon.
You're listening to Debbie Griffin. Go ahead.
I am.
This rings a bell, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm sorry, a bit nervous.
Take your time, yeah.
But my 16-year-old son presented with every morning he was getting up for school and he'd just go straight to the bathroom, vomit, back out. And then he'd have vertigo, really bad, and then vomit till about 12 o'clock. And then he'd be sort of fine for the rest of the day. So this went on until about 2 weeks ago. He had an MRI. Mm-hmm. He had all the other tests on, so they gave him a brain scan, you know.
Okay.
So his everything was fine, but they found this thing called a UBO, which is an unidentified bright object. Don't ask. She said it was basically like a light in his head. It's like a I've never heard, the doctor never even heard of a UBO, and she said that could have been causing the vomiting.
But what could, okay, I don't understand
it's
what a UBO
serious,
is, but what's the cure?
Yeah. Well, he's kind of has just kind of come around over the past week.
Okay, but they didn't.
He had
the MRI. He had the brain scan. They didn't prescribe anything, but they did describe something.
Yes. Yeah. This UBO. I mean, that girl that you're speaking to,
Debbie. Yeah.
Debbie. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. So it was just so traumatic for him. Mm. He couldn't go outside the door. It wasn't nerves or anything.
It wasn't anything to do with school?
No. No, definitely not. Definitely not. Definitely not. But he's totally, like, he's come around.
Well, was it, there was, it was described, and there was no prescription for dealing with it. But were you relieved that it wasn't serious?
Yeah, I was, but I was like, what is it? They gave him anti-nausea tablets that didn't help, anti-vertigo tablets that didn't help.
Okay.
But my other son, well, he's 18, he's had severe chronic IBS-C since he's 11. And he started off with, like, vomiting. Mm. But there's no cure for what he has.
That's
either.
Irritable bowel syndrome.
It's slightly worse than that. Like, it's very debilitating. Like, he's only got 2 days out of a week where he can go out, you know. So
stay with us, Sarah. But Debbie, we hear of people vomiting with migraines.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
No, I can't. No, I don't want to go down this road because I've no medical, and never would I say I've no medical. But you're saying the medics are baffled, Debbie.
Yeah, like, as I said, it's not even on the... When I'm starting for that race, I'm in great form, and I could... My preferred distance is a half marathon. So when I'm doing... Like, I could be into that, having a great run, up to maybe 16K, and then I start feeling nauseous because it's like I'm pushing myself to my extreme, my 100% effort. And that's where, you know, it feels like someone's punched me in my stomach. And it starts like that, and it just gets worse and worse. And, like, my last race, one of my races last year down in Tullamore, it was one of the national half marathons, and I had 800 metres to go. I was on the side of a roundabout, about in the middle of the road, on my hands and knees, getting sick. And some woman says to me, "Come on, get up. Get up and walk it even. You're nearly there." I got up and I ran, and I ended up winning a Leinster medal. And I got a silver medal in my category. Okay. I have never given up.
Okay, well, Debbie, come at it again. Use that phrase again. A different angle. What harm? What's the harm?
It takes from the fun of it. I love it, but it takes... Like, it's nearly
Now, bear with me on this. How long does the vomiting bout last?
I would be over that in 10 minutes after the race.
So what harm? Apart from the awful sensation in your throat.
It's really difficult to finish the race. It's so easy to stop because it takes a huge effort to continue. It takes every
Bit
of strength.
Maybe your body, and you're still quite young, you're in your 50s, maybe your body is telling you, don't be pushing yourself. Don't be pushing me too hard.
Like, it could happen at a 4K cross-country race, so it's not even...
Okay, not tearing. Okay. You have an answer. Okay, William Bourke. William, Joe at rt.ie 51551 is the text number. William, you're listening to Debbie and indeed Sarah. Go ahead, William.
I am indeed, yeah. No, I have a similar... Well, I don't think it's as similar as Debbie, but would have completed the... Hi, Debbie, how you doing? I would have completed the Dublin City Marathon last year. Last October, and after that, when I tried to get back into training again, probably 2 or 3 weeks after it, I started getting nausea within the first probably 3 or 4 kilometres, and it would go to I'd literally kind of have to stop, walk, and then get going again, stop, walk, get going again, and then I think the last event I did was the half marathon in Waterford there, the WAC one on the first weekend in December.
I was sad as shit.
I did
the same thing.
I got sick 3 times and I did a PB.
Your personal best, yeah.
I would have got sick on the finish line as well.
I'm going down the route now of getting the... I'm only after getting a scope done down into my stomach. So that's all after coming back clear and everything like that. And
just to be clear, William, sorry for interrupting. You're saying you cannot run because of this nausea feed.
I can't do any exercise. Well, very minimal.
Okay, but Debbie can. You can run, Debbie.
Yeah. Exactly. It's funny. It sounds very similar, though.
Okay, William, if you're running the marathon, you've buddies and pals or whatever who've done it before. Any of them say anything to you that you need more fluids or protein or I don't know?
No, because I'd be pretty good, because like I did, like I've probably picked up running. I used to do kind of duathlons and triathlons and stuff like that. I used to do a lot of road racing on the bike when I was younger. So I really only started running properly for 2 years ago, and then set myself the challenge of Dublin City Marathon last year. Did a 16-week pretty intense training block, because I was really happy with the time that I did, and there was nothing. There was no symptoms whatsoever. So it's only after
it's out of the blue.
The marathon that it really started to kick off, because I can't, like even now when I try to go on the turbo in my room, chase my 5-year-old daughter down the road only after teaching her how to cycle, I feel nauseous.
Ah.
It's crazy. Yeah, so it's a brisk walk, I'd feel now, it as well.
Well, the only thing that's, well, maybe the only thing I can see that's changed is your age. You've got older, obviously.
Well, I'm 44. I'd like to think I'm kind of...
Well, that's young,
over my prime.
Debbie, yeah.
Joe, I have actually got quicker with age. I'm still getting PBs.
As I said,
age in athletics, there's no age limit. As I said, there's a lady called Pauline Morn. She would have done the Tullamore half marathon last year, and she set a world record, and she's in her 60. She's 65. She was faster than me. She passed me by, and she won. She set her world record last year.
Okay, at 51551, Dara, you're listening to Debbie. Go ahead, Dara.
Yes, I had a similar problem there. Back in 2004, I started vomiting copiously whenever I was running for longer than maybe 80, 90 minutes. I just did. The nausea would kick in, and then I felt like I needed to vomit but couldn't. I would eventually, but it was like the other speakers said, it would be absolutely overpowering. I went to a nutritionist in Cork, and he recommended electrolyte drinks, and
I hadn't
looked back since. Now they work wonders for me. I'm just wondering if
I think it was one the doctor said to make sure he has electrolytes. Electrolytes are really important. You know,
well, obviously, I'm presuming Liveline listeners are intelligent enough to know that everything carries a codicil saying always consult your GP. What are electrolyte drinks? What are they? Give me a name.
Things like Lucozade, Sport, and all them.
Okay.
I tried the Lucozade. That never did much for me. It was a brand you could get in any sports shop. Can I name the name?
Yes, of course. If it's legal.
It was called. Yeah. It was called High Five.
High Five. Dara, sorry for cutting across. What does an electrolyte drink address?
I think it's the salt imbalance in the body.
Okay.
So the more you sweat, the more salt you use.
Of course.
And whatever effect it was having on me, it would cause me to get nauseous and then vomit. Now, since I went on, and it worked for me. I'm not saying it's going to work for everyone, but I went from feeling nauseous and wanting to vomit at the 80, 90 minute mark. I pushed it out to maybe, like I used to do ultra marathons. I wouldn't get that sensation until maybe 4 or 5 hours into a run.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, has it affected you? Does it still affect you?
Well, I've cut down on the long distance running now, so I don't take the electrolyte drink anymore unless I'm doing long distance cycling, and I don't run much more than a half marathon now anymore. So neither the nausea, the nausea hasn't affected me since. No, it dogged me for 10 years. But since I went on the electrolyte drink, I never looked back.
Well, I hope you heard William before you saying if he chases, or not even chases, if he gallops or saunters after his daughter in the house, he's prone to feelings of deep nausea.
No, touch wood. I haven't gotten that far yet.
Okay, but you're not touching wood, you're touching high five. High five. Okay, Joe, thanks, Dara. Joe, 0818 715 815. Joseph. You there, Joe?
Yes, Joe.
Come in. Joe, calling Joe. Joe,
talk to Joe.
Yeah, talk to me, yeah.
Right, Joe, I said to a researcher there in a text that I'm in my 70s now. The only sport at the time that I participated was a bit of cross-country running. And exactly the same thing as that Lady Debbie had that problem with. And my solution, after a long time of wondering how can I get over, was I could feel the anxiety coming on pre a race, but never in training.
Okay.
And I used to allow myself and sometimes encourage myself to get sick.
Oh, good luck.
I know, but it did work, believe it or not.
You see, I don't get that pre-race. I don't get that. I don't feel nervous before the race, so it's not anxiety. I don't feel that.
Right.
But as far as the electrolytes are concerned, it would be no benefit to me in a cross-country 3 or 4K because I'm already well hydrated. You know,
but would there not be a bit of it? Debbie, would you not have a bit of anxiety and anticipation or looking forward to the race?
Nervous excitement, but nothing that should, like everybody, nothing that should cause that.
Symptoms remind me of my symptoms many, many moons ago. But just the anxiety, the anticipation, the looking forward to it. And one go on.
Sorry, you know, the head is connected to the stomach. You know, the mind is connected to the stomach. There's a huge connection between the head and the stomach.
Yeah.
It's like your stomach is your second brain. So there might be just a tiny bit of anxiety there. Okay. You're unaware of anxiety. Stomach.
Sarah, can I extend your point, Sarah, and to Debbie? And Debbie, why worry about it? What are you worried about?
You can't prevent that kind of anxiety.
I'd like to stop the nausea because it's unpleasant and it's very... difficult to finish the race with. I have to put a huge amount of strength into extra strength. I already have it in the legs, but it's just, you know.
Have you tried meditation or yoga, Debbie?
Yes, I did yoga and all that. Yeah.
Mindfulness.
The same.
That's it.
And I just, as I said, if I could get an answer, if some miracle cure, I'd be delighted. But otherwise, it wouldn't stop me running.
Debbie, that's what I was thinking for my son. Every morning, I was like, oh, please, somebody.
I'd be excited if someone could just say, do this, you know.
Yeah, but the most important thing, I don't want to gradate them because, as I say, I'm not medically. But the most interesting thing I've heard, two things. One, Sarah said, when the diagnosis came true that it wasn't the vomiting in her son and the vertigo wasn't, it was upsetting, but it wasn't life-threatening in any shape or form. And so that's number one. And number two was William saying that he has it much worse, that if he even saunters after his daughter, he gets his feet. And he's an accomplished runner. He's done anyone who does the marathons, an accomplished runner, if you ask me, in any shape or form. But so would that not be reassuring, Debbie?
Oh, yeah, it is, definitely. Yeah, I'm lucky to be able to still run.
You just don't want it, Debbie. You just don't want it.
Yeah, it'd be nicer not to.
But
I am very lucky,
away.
I have to say. Yeah.
Okay, where's Tom?
Have you touched base with the sports clinic or anything like that? Have you done... kind of treadmills or ram tests or anything like that to simulate it so someone can look at you doing
it. I haven't. I'm looking for a few contacts today, hopefully.
Tom Heron. Tom Heron's in Tyrone. Tom.
Yes, how are you?
Yeah, good. How are you? You're listening to Debbie and indeed Sarah and indeed William and indeed Dara and indeed Joe. Tom, you're a psychotherapist.
I'm a psychotherapist, yes. But basically I work with lots of athletes in different sports.
Okay.
And basically, I've found out, I'm also an Oxygen Advantage Master Instructor. And basically, what we do is we show athletes how to breathe. And basically, when we don't breathe properly, it'll manifest itself in many different symptoms. Mm. And one of them is getting sick.
Okay.
You know, and it's amazing. I worked with a guy that did 60 ultra marathons in 60 days. So basically, you can imagine, and an ultra marathon is 39.2 miles. So basically, he did 60 consecutive ultra marathons in 60 days. So basically, that's endurance at its left, if you like. So we had to get over many obstacles there. And it's amazing. And one of the fundamental things is...
Okay.
One of the fundamental things is learn to breathe in and out through the nose.
Well,
learn to do your running, breathing in and out through the nose.
Well, that's a very... If you know somebody who is panicking, or you know somebody who's tearing up at a funeral where they don't want to tear up because they're speaking, you just say some deep breaths through your nose. Deep breaths through your nose. That will help you calm down.
In through your nose is for asthmatics, I think, as well.
Okay. And is
so, it is. It's really useful for asthmatics. Plus, it will reduce dehydration by 42%.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. It's a very precise figure, Tom.
So, what is the name of that breathing technique, then?
It's basically the oxygen advantage. And it's OXYGEN advantage. And basically, it's amazing what it can do, because it'll work with anxiety. It'll work with all sorts of different symptoms. But for athletes, it's specifically for athletes, because athletes suffer from all those things as well.
Okay. But does that mean...
How do I go about that?
So sorry, Debbie.
Finding out about that. Sorry, Joe.
How do you go about it? Go to Oxygen Advantage.
Online.
Go to whatever phone you're on. Go to oxygenadvantage.com. And you find the details there. And you can download their app. And if you go to the App Store, or go into the... If it's an Android, go and go Oxygen Advantage app and download it. And it'll give you information about all the things that you can do, and it'll give you exercises, and it's amazing.
Cool. Yeah, I'll
But does that mean, Debbie, are you conscious of your breathing? Because you'll have to be conscious of your breathing if the concentration now has to be on breathing in and out through your nose.
To be honest, not really.
Okay, well, maybe that's worth trying. Yeah, it's very straightforward.
I don't think anybody
it's
is.
It's cost-free, yeah.
No, it takes a bit of getting used to, and it takes a bit of things. And look, give her my number, and if I can help her in any way, I will. I'll gladly help her, and I'll coach her through it, just so you see what it's like.
Okay.
And it takes a little time to get through it, because we breathe, like, we're born obligate, what we call obligate nasal breathers. Babies until they're about 6 months old cannot breathe through their mouth.
No.
Okay. Okay,
their
Tom,
bellies, when you look at a baby and their belly is... Sorry, Joe. And you know when you look at a baby asleep in its cot?
Yes, the belly is going
up and down. They're not breathing from their shoulders. They're breathing from their tummy, which is the natural way that we're supposed
to breathe. And what are you saying to me there, Sarah? What is that telling me? The baby, the belly breathing from the baby. What
because
is that?
It's, you know, they come straight out of the womb knowing how to breathe. And then when you come into the world, you get old, you get all the pressures of life, and you start breathing, you know, from your shoulders. Yeah. Instead, the natural way of breathing, and watching your tummy rise and fall and rise and fall into your nose and out through your nose. That's the way we're supposed to breathe as humans.
Okay. Okay, well,
maybe that would help. So have a go and see how she gets on. Yeah. So, and if I can help in any way,
there's a whole thing in mindfulness, and it's free as well. You breathe in. I think it's the 4-7-11 method, isn't it? Breathe in, hold your breath for 7. Breathe in 4 seconds, hold your breath for 7, and breathe out slowly for 11, just to calm down. But anyway, okay, that's interesting. Sarah, William Bourke, Tom Heron, Gordon Milmaga, Joe, and Debbie Griffin, thank you all. Slán.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Keep the light out with our new ranges of blackout curtains and blinds, perfect for a peaceful sleep and a brighter start.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe at RTE.ie 51551 is our text number. Michelle is there. Paul is there. Michelle, good afternoon.
Hello. Hi, Joe. Good afternoon. Lovely to talk with you.
Likewise, because we were talking a few weeks ago about matchmaking. We had Gus on the line, and he was telling us, it's free, by the way. He was telling us what he's done. And you, among a significant number of people, were struck by this. Now, you say you joined a dating agency, and they're 10 a penny now, as you know, online.
Yeah.
But they invariably involve, apart from the likes of Tinder or whatever, they invariably involve money. Did a dating agency you joined, did you have to pay?
I had to pay. It was close on 1,000.
Wow. 1,000 euro?
Yeah. Yeah, close to it.
And what were you guaranteed for that, insofar as anyone can guarantee anything in matchmaking?
I would meet five. I'd have five introductions.
Okay. You were guaranteed five intros?
Yes.
How can they guarantee five intros? Anyway,
well,
that's what they said. Yeah. Okay, they guaranteed five intros for €1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that go for you?
Well, I went to all the introductions. And one thing I noticed about the agency, when I was listening to Gus, this came into my mind, that the agency, I didn't actually meet anybody that, you know, anything worked that I worked out with. But I actually felt that the person in the agency, while she was very kind, she was the first person I met. She must have left, or she went into a different role within the agency. So I was meeting different people all the time. And I felt, how did they know me? Because I'd only met one person. But from when I was listening to Gus,
Gus Martin,
I actually thought, this person sounds very down to earth, very earthy.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who would take what he's doing to heart.
Okay, and he's not. Well, let's remind people, Michelle, and thanks for mentioning Gus Martin. Let's remind people of some of what Gus told us on the program last week.
For years, the last 20 years, I'm a small matchmaker as well. We have a good few matches made and we have a few weddings and whatnot down through the years. We don't charge, in fairness. It was a booming trade then, and that's why tender might have taken over a little bit. But this way, we meet the girl beforehand, we meet the fella beforehand, we do our background stuff on them. You know what I mean? They're always 100%. And then we meet them together the first night.
Okay.
At a GA game, at a rugby game, you know what I mean? Sports out, and they're not all from farming background, they're all walks of life.
Okay. And Michelle, I mean, I'm being intrusive and I say, like, what would you be saying to Gus? What would you be looking for?
I'm actually looking for somebody I felt Gus actually was an example of the type of person, in a sense, very down to earth, very earthy, sincere, genuine, just somebody that wants to meet somebody. I kind of felt within the agency there was that sense that you have to pay another close on €1,000 if you want to have five more introductions. And the fact that the people in the agency kept changing.
Okay, you made that point. But when you say, I presume you have to fill out a form to say what type of person I am. Which is awkward for any of us.
No. I think most people in general are pretty, you know, sincere when they're looking to meet somebody. And I think as well, when you get to a certain age in life, you're looking for somebody who is reliable, dependable, normal, just down to earth, and a happy person.
Okay.
Somebody definitely who would share the same interests.
And the qualities, and you've written them here for us, are honesty, genuine, down to earth, animal lover, walker, outdoors person. When you filled out the form with the agency that you pay the money to, did you get anyone that came in next or near ticking those boxes?
One or two people might have been close, but not necessarily what I was looking for. Yeah. I felt I'm not perfect but I felt the essence of the person that I presented as the first day within the agency. I was looking for somebody that I had outlined or described. I heard Gus and the fact that he did not charge a single cent, I thought, this is unreal.
Did you tell the agency you're looking for someone of a particular age group?
Oh, gosh, yeah, you do. You have to ask that question.
Okay, are they the dates you got?
No, in fact, most people would have been a good bit older.
Okay.
Than you
asked for. Then you specify. Yes. Okay, Paul, yes. Come in, Paul. You contacted us as well.
Hello, Paul. Yes.
Now go ahead, Paul.
I just want to get that man's number, or get that man's number that he was a matchmaker on a sheep farmer. I talked to him then myself, like, you know.
Okay, well, we could have easily given you, well, we don't give you a number, we could have easily passed on your number.
I'll pass on my number to him and he can ring me at night time between 7:30 and 9:30.
Yeah, don't give out that information, Paul, please. Have you tried dating agencies where money changes?
I have, but when money was mentioned, I just pulled out. So okay. I did, like, you know.
And did you know when you, and don't give me any names, obviously, Paul, but did you know when you contacted them initially that money would have to change hands?
Yes, correct.
Well, then why did you contact them if you're not willing to pay money?
I don't think you do. I don't think you should pay money to meet someone. I don't, like, you can meet someone, like, you know, and it'll take its toll from there, then, like, face to face, and so it is.
And have you any idea how much money they were looking for, Paul?
It was big money. Ireland's own, they were looking for big money and other people.
And what's big money?
What the last person said, they were £1,000.
Wow. And what were you guaranteed for £1,000? Well, sorry, I don't know.
I was guaranteed nothing. It was just money they wanted it. So.
Okay.
So it is. Yeah. And I'll just leave that number to
you. Okay, if you don't want to give me...
Contact that man can contact me.
Right. See, I don't want to come across as in... I thought you were going to talk about Egypt.
Yeah,
but and it sounds.
I'm single as well, like.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. And you're looking for someone.
For friendship to go here and there. Yeah.
And have you used any other non-paying? Like, don't Ireland's Own still have a column?
No, Ireland's Own. I tried that. Sure, they wanted money as well.
I did it for the ad, that's understandable.
They wanted money.
Okay.
Right, so nice talking to you.
Paul.
If you can get that man to contact me, and I'll thank you for everything. Like, bye now, God bless.
God bless you, Paul, Paul is resonating with me so much, because as I've been boring people that know me for the last 10 days, I've been reading the plays of John B. Keane, Maul, Big Maggie, Sharon's Grave, The Chastitute, Many Young Men of 20. They are absolutely breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. And there's a lot of them about loneliness and obviously emigration. And John B. wrote them, he was a genius, he died age 72, but he wrote them in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And they are so, so on the money even today. And I learned so much, and well, the language in it is absolutely mesmeric, but just the loneliness in it is that John B. portrays, and I just heard it there on Paul's voice. John MacDonald, John, good afternoon.
How's it going, Joe?
What do you want to tell me?
How long have you got? I think I was in the house one day, and it just your own show was on, and I happened to hear your man Gus talking, and I thought, I just liked hearing him talk. I'm a country man myself, and a very level approach. And I suppose he reminded me of the dealers and that. You know, he'd have a good eye in his head, and he knows what he wants. And I suppose he'd be good at actually probably matchmaking as a thing. You'd be thinking, do you see that would fit with him or different people? And
have you tried one of these? Just to start. Have you tried, John, one of these dating agencies where money has to change hands?
I've been on one or two of those online sites. I was on one of them, it changed, and I mean, the charge like a 25 quid a month or something. And I'm sure I'm on at least 10 years. But what I find about them is it's a shotgun approach. Like, I mean, you can fill in your profile and what you want them, but then a day they'll fire 15-20 people at you every day. And I mean, it's just a real. And I mean, you might say you want someone within 20 or 30 miles of where you live. And I mean, they'll give you people in England or Scotland or anywhere. It's a very broad based, and yeah, I've replied to some of them, but I think you really have to, you know, there's a lot of work to kind of do it, and then it's all about, you know, I suppose I grew up at the stage where you went to the dance halls or the pubs, and you met someone, a bit of a chat and stuff like that, and or you met one somebody, and again, it's back to how we think.
Yeah, and you see, on the one hand, just this is pursuant to what I was saying a few minutes ago about John B. Keane. On the one hand, it sounds like a throwback, and Gus Martin, he was a gorgeous man, sounded like a throwback to a different time, given that we've dating agencies now, and we've online and Tinder and the smartphone, etc., etc., and swipe left and swipe right. I still haven't got the hang of it. But we have all these online. But I'm surprised by the number of people who are saying, I would trust a matchmaker more than I would trust somebody who's looking for my money.
Yeah.
There's a lot in what you say. I think it's almost like, and from what he said, and I mean, this created nothing. I mean, he started up, and his father-in-law, I think, started first, and then he got a, he met the father-in-law's daughter, and he matched them, and then it's going to the stage where he himself and the wife work at it, and I think it's maybe they do maybe the hard work for you, and you know,
I just wonder,
young guys nowadays,
John, just generally, what part of the country are you from?
I'm a Tyrone man.
You're Tyrone. Is there any matchmakers up around Tyrone? Have you heard?
There was one. There was one up around the border, Donegal country.
I just wonder: are there matchmakers still on the go? The old-fashioned John B. Keane matchmaker.
Well, it was like an agency. It was a two's company, but I don't know if they're online. I mean, I did contact them, and
it's a knock. Does anyone know? Is the Knock Marriage Bureau still going? I think they are.
Oh. Joe?
Yes, who's that?
Hi. I don't think they're still going, because I actually joined them at one stage, and they stopped because the amount of people looking for a match fell. But the one thing that they did, they actually refunded my money, them. And whereas I agree with the other person who said sometimes it seems like a shotgun, you have to make this decision and accept the agency's offer, but you have to pay up first.
Oh, I know that. Well, they have to survive as well. Just for younger listeners, when we say Knock Marriage Bureau, it's a reference to the Knock Shrine in County Mayo, and it began as Knock Marriage Introductions. That speaks of its time as well. That began in 1968, but it closed after 50 years, and it closed in 2019. And they say that they say they had 1,000 marriages.
Yeah.
And the reason they closed, there was no longer viable to run the service. The running costs were 50,000 a year, and if you joined the Knock Marriage Bureau, you would pay, which is a lot less than what other. You were paying 200 euro a year. So who was paying 20? Who was paying 25 quid a month?
That was me. Okay. But basically, any time you do go on it, you're always bombarded with you'll get three times more things, all this sort of stuff, and more and more ways to spend your money if you want to do it. And I think this meeting thing is, they'll also target it. What I find, actually, there's a lot of flipping scam articles on it. There's more people on it, I find, who weren't genuine. And someone can stick up a profile, and you might talk to them, and the next thing they find that, even from the dictation coming back, you knew that the English wasn't their first language, and whereas if somebody had said they were from, Dublin or something like that. I think there's a lot of ungenuine people on it, and also scam artists who would sort of play and want to come along and say.
Most of them, I presume, are genuine. Okay, John McDonald, Gurumila Magath, Michelle, and it's an interesting well that I didn't think had much water in it when Gus was on, but it has, obviously, the need for a no hands, no fees, no strings attached no fees, matchmaking in the old John B. Keane style. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Robbie Burns yesterday on the programme, I hope you heard him, and he struck a chord with a lot of people. Robbie, as he told us, didn't sound it, but then again, these days, people are so young, despite their age. Robbie told us he was 72, and as he said himself, I look like a granddad. And I think he is a granddad. And he was being abused on the dart, both on the platform and on the train itself, by a group of 14-year-olds who, as he said, it would have been obvious to them that he had the demeanour of a granddad. And they, on the one hand, tried to trick him with a stupid offer. Did he want a piece of pizza? And handed him a box, only to discover that the box was empty. And they flung the box on the ground and he asked them to put it in the bin. And then when he got on the train, they got on the same carriage. And then they had a packet of chips, French fries or whatever, and they start flicking them at Robbie, the four of them. And one of them started kicking Robbie, and a younger man, so to speak, intervened and threw three of the thugs off the dart at the next station. Now, Frances, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What happened to you in your case, Frances?
Yeah, well, I was just listening to Robbie on the radio yesterday, and it just brought to mind an incident that happened about a year and a half ago, but it's on the Lewis, not on the Dart. And I just want to also state that I'm a big supporter of public transport.
Absolutely.
We have a family, we don't have a car, and we've always used Darts and Lewis's. Mm-hmm. But I was... my parents were unwell. They live in the west of Ireland, so I was getting the Lewis over to Houston and then the train down to the west of Ireland for about a year or 2 years.
Yeah.
Then I was coming back one Sunday evening, and the Lewis was absolutely jam-packed. It was going from Houston up to into town to Abbey Street, and every seat was taken. So there was a lot of kerfuffle and shuffling, and a group of kids, 12 to 14-year-olds, running up and down the carriage. And they seem to have been chasing a chap with a crutch.
Okay.
And they're literally chasing him off the... So he was moving up and down. So I hadn't really noticed then. Then when we were outside Collins' barracks, and one, the bigger of the group, I would say he's about 13 or 14, began to imitate. He stood in the aisle to the right of me. So I was sitting in the four seats facing a black man, very elegant, lovely, dignified black man. So this youngster, who was 14, stood in the aisle and began to make sounds like an ape. And he began to scratch his armpits. And I completely caught it. What on earth? And before we knew it, something was flying in the air towards him, towards the chap who was sitting opposite me, he was bald. but it missed him and it got me, and it was an egg. And the egg basically broke on me and slid down the front of my lovely new Mac. Because the Lewis was so packed, nobody knew what to do. So nobody said anything. So I was humiliated for this man sitting opposite me. I didn't mind having the egg so much. And I just said to him, I'm so sorry about this. And he was saying, it's okay, it's okay. And he looked really guilty because he was black. So this little thug, the bigger guy, he jumped off the Lewis at Collins' barracks.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting the Lewis quite a bit, the red line, but during this time to Houston. Another morning I was getting on it. It was very, very early in the morning, and two little 12-year-old guys hopped on, again going towards Abbey Street. So this would have been the Green Line, I think.
Okay.
And again, there was a black man sitting. The carriage was empty this time, sitting opposite us. Mm-hmm. And they literally moved in. They were so feral. So the two of them moved in, and the guy was in his 50s. They moved in, and they cornered him. One sat opposite him, one sat beside him, and they began to touch him. And they began to touch his hair, and they started saying, how come your hair is so curly? And he was so dignified, he just kept staring straight ahead, and then he laughed with them. And I was so ashamed for him, so I just told him to leave him alone and move off. So, of course, they rounded on me and started saying pretty abusive things towards me. When they got off the Lewis, they thumped the window beside me really heavily. I was kind of expecting that. And I went to the guy afterwards and I said, I'm really, really sorry that they're doing this to you. And he was saying, it's not them, it's their parents. He says, this is the way he was dealing with it.
Yeah.
He was laughing back at them. So the third bit of the story was, another time I was coming back from Houston and I felt I had to say something. So I got one of the guards at the station. I said, do you know what's going on? And I explained to him what had happened to these two gents. And he said, you think that's bad? Last week, they set fire to a woman's hair on the
loose.
Yeah. So basically, it's just control. The Lewis is fantastic, but the kids are out of order. The behaviour is dreadful. Now, they may have since put a guard onto the Lewis, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But these kids, they get on in gangs and they seem to always pick somebody who's vulnerable. So somebody with a crutch, a black person. And as Robbie was saying yesterday, a slightly elderly man. Myself, I'm in my late 50s. You know, so anyone who's anyway slightly different, they're fair game. And it's often the girls do it as well. And I've noticed they seem to target single older men because they know they can't touch them back and they form a circle around them.
Well, ma'am, when you say single, you mean men who are on their, older men who are on their own, so to speak. Yeah. Like Robbie, like Robbie,
It's particularly kind of vicious, yeah. That was all I wanted to say.
And one of them talked to you about pornography.
Oh, yeah, they're talking about nanny porn. Nanny porn, that was to get at me, I suppose.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and now the other, but people who haven't used the Lewis or the dart, and I understand the vast majority of people in the country don't have access to either the Lewis or the dart. But the problem is, once you get on, now you could say the same about a bus, but a bus can stop anywhere. The driver is accessible. The bus can stop anywhere and you can beg to be let off. But on the Lewis, you have no contact with the driver. You're not allowed. There's no way of contact. You can bang on the glass, but it could be five carriages beyond you at this stage. You have no way. You're trapped on that carriage, so to speak. And the same
That's
on the
true.
Dart. And the Dart's even worse because you're on a railway track. You can't stop in the middle of nowhere. But the Lewis won't stop either unintentionally. The Lewis won't stop as requested and can't stop in the middle of nowhere. But you do feel trapped, and you do kind of, if you say to yourself, well, I take these on or try and check them, you then realise, well, hang on, if I try and check them and they come at me, I've no way of getting out of this carriage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and they know that, and that's why they do it. And these kids are like only 12 or 13, and it's all of a gang, group of them. Yeah, okay.
But you're right, public transport is so important, and it's getting much...
Fantastic.
Lewis
to Houston is brilliant, but what I'm wondering is, if tourists are coming to Houston Station, and they're way into town with Lewis, and they're witnessing that, you know, it's destroying it, really. So they have to have security, more security than they have.
Yeah, but I love tourists, to a man and a woman, but it's not just tourists, is anyone witnessing that? Anyone witnessing
Absolutely.
That?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Francis, good to meet you, Margaret. That's Francis, Joe at rt.ie, 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Keep the light out with our new ranges of blackout curtains and blinds, perfect for a peaceful sleep and a brighter start.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Mike Keller has contacted us. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay, and I recognise your voice, and it's a while since I've heard from you. You're keeping well.
Well, if St. Peter don't call me, I'll be 80 this time next year.
Right. And if it's the same Mike Callagher, it's the same voice I'm hearing, slightly older. You were in the police department in the States, were you not?
San Francisco.
Yeah. And you didn't leave your heart there. You brought it to Ireland, and that's where you've been very happy. But you have an O.J. Simpson connection.
Actually, a few of them in a sense, Joe, but there was one let me put it this way, since you opened the subject there about being in the police department, yes, that was my job, and as San Francisco was a great place for shooting movies of all descriptions.
Of course, yeah.
One of the ones that was prominent out there, and I was in the periphery of some of them on traffic-wise when they were shooting the streets of San Francisco. I don't know if they showed that here in Ireland. But
we grew up on it, yeah.
A very popular series. Yeah. Now, what would happen in those situations is they would detail Most of the we call them in the movies when they do them, they have fake cops. But yeah. when they're oftentimes seen, like on that Towering Inferno, all of the fire department that respond there and right up to the door of the fire are real firemen. Okay. The cops that were, and there weren't that many of them on there, were real cops up to there. They paid no part, actually, in the acting. My scene on that was where I was working traffic, accident investigation, and I rode a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And on the day in question, I was directing traffic at Stockton and California Street. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching the movie, you'd see the fire engines roaring down the road. And I'm the fellow with the white helmet there, telling them to go up the way. Okay. That was my only part. I knew nothing about what they were filming. I didn't know the name of it or any actors because
Come back to O.J. Simpson. Was he in that movie? Even though he's not on the poster, was he in that movie?
He was, yes.
Okay.
I know nothing about. The only thing that always make me think afterwards about the O.J. Simpson situation, and I'll just skip a little bit from it.
Okay.
In the O.J. Simpson trial in Los Angeles, right?
Mm-hmm.
They brought in they had the dream team. They had them of the attorneys, and one of them was, does the name ring a bell with you, F. Lee Bailey from Boston?
No, it doesn't, but keep going.
He was a flamboyant, pompous individual strutting around the courtroom inside and there. And he was one of the ones they brought in inside on that case.
Okay.
Now, I didn't know him at the time, but his claim to fame was that he defended all of the radical groups like the Black Panthers, the Brother Men, and so on. And he was financed by Jane Fonda. She was his money man. Now, the irony of the situation as it involved several years later, there was, do you remember Patty Hearst, when she was kidnapped?
Yeah, I remember that.
She was the heir to the Hearst family. Now, the suits, as I call them, they were the people in the intelligence department of our department and so on. They were raiding a house for, we didn't know who it was, for this place in San Francisco. And us uniform trashers, they referred to us, were sent out at the street corners to stop nobody walking up the street or the sidewalk while they conducted their business. Okay, I was down at one corner, and fella came out of a building, tall, black man, walked down the street, and I thought, how come nobody stopped him up the way? So he stopped halfway when he saw me, and he went down what I thought was tying his shoelace. When he came up to me, I stopped him. I asked him where he lived, and he said, up the road. I asked him his address. He didn't know it. He said he just moved there. So when you stop somebody like that, you're entitled to give them a frisk search of their immediate area.
But Mike, where is O.J. Simpson in all of this?
I will tell you in a minute.
Sorry,
telling you about how F. Lee Bailey was the man that defended. F. D. Bailey, what happened was, I found a gun in this fella's boat.
Okay. Wow.
Okay?
Yeah, okay.
And the whole thing was that that gun was tracked to a shooting back in New York, in which a Brinks armored car was held up and two of them killed.
Wow.
And the gun was tracked to it. Now, if this man could be extradited back to New York for the murder back there, so be it. But F. Lee Bailey was brought in to defend this fella in San Francisco on the basis that it was an illegal search and seizure because you're not allowed to go down into his boat. Okay. Just prior to the case starting, the district attorney that was there, the assistant district attorney, said to me, he said, Mike, he said, you're in trouble today because F. Lee Bailey is in here and he is going to come along and he loves tearing cops apart. Mm-hmm. By the time he gets through with them, they'll be running off the scene. So So I said, fair enough. So he asked me quickly, tell me a few little things about yourself. And I told him I served in the military. And I told him where I served in the military, which was Fort Myer, Virginia, better known as Arlington Cemetery. And he was kind of half astonished at that. So we got into the courtroom, and F. Lee Bailey comes on, and he's strutting around and asking me and where were they from, tell him. And then he asked me if my logbook, that's my book you write down on anything you do at a court scene. Crime scene. And he comes along from the juries and he's looking at it. He turned it sideways and he turned it upside down. And he looked over at me and he said to me, Officer Kelleher, from looking here at this, it looked like you didn't get very far in the education system, which was an awful comment, right?
Sure was, yeah.
Now, it was immediately, there's a word to that, to scrubbed off as evidence, but to set in front of the jury. And this Bailey was trying to make me up as being an uneducated bum of an Irishman.
Oh, he took on the wrong man, Mike. He took on the wrong man. Didn't he?
What had made it nice, and that's where F. Lee Bailey, when I heard of F. Lee Bailey defending O.J. Simpson, the district attorney, who normally couldn't bring this up in front of the jury, he said to them, Mr. Bailey here has made you up as just a low-life Irishman inside here, and he's enjoying it. Would you tell the jury a little bit about yourself? And I told them I was from Ireland, and I came over and I worked in construction in Chicago, and I got drafted into the army. And I took out citizenship, and I came out here, and I joined the police department. And then he asked him, where did you serve in the military? I said, I served in Fort Myer, Virginia.
Okay.
And, of course, John Darrow extended it and said to the jury, do you know where that is? That is the most prestigious place. It's
Arlington
Cemetery.
Okay, save it as my two things.
One, I remember F. Lee Bailey. He'd be strutting around. He sat down in his chair.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, Joe, he almost broke the arse of the chair trying to disappear.
Okay.
So,
now, Mike.
So I'm only tying in the two.
Yeah, I know. God, you took. Anyway. Okay, so that's, by the way, just to our legal department, who I'm sure at the minute are currently looking for the defibrillators. F. Lee Bailey died in 2021. Mike, will we get to O.J. Simpson after this break, please?
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Okay, Mike, O.J. Simpson, did you meet him when you were filming Towering Inferno? Did you come across him in your work or hear about him in your work as a police with the SFPD?
A
policeman
in a roundabout way. Let
okay,
me put
tell
it
us, yeah,
I was
tell,
at
tell
American
me.
American Legion convention some years ago in Arizona, and there was a fellow police officer from Los Angeles there as we all got chatting, talking about mutual talk. And the subject, I asked this man, he was a retired sergeant, and I said, and his story, he said, the area I worked in Los Angeles was the Brentwood District, familiar with the murder involving O.J. Simpson, etc., right?
Nicole and so, Ron Goodman, yeah.
So the subject arose inside about O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
And he related to me, although he had nothing to do actually with it, he was supervising the cops who were doing the scene as a supervisor does.
Okay.
He mentioned to me that leading up to that murder scene, O.J. Simpson enjoyed a charmed life in the sense that his wife that he was married to, Nicole Brown,
first
wife was a strong black woman, and she divorced him. She took no shit from him.
Yeah.
Now, Nicole Brown came along, and it was a common thing every few weeks, the cops were called. They knew exactly where to go. And that's on the record, by the way. And he literally beat the thud out of her, and nothing happened.
When
cops rang the doorbell, O.J. was out with a big smile and a handshake. Ah, look, I was just putting her in her place. She was stepping out of bounds.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And she wouldn't be seen for a few weeks until such time as her face came back to normal.
Oh, my God. That's horrific.
And he got away with it because of who he was. And, of course, I hate to say it as there, but he, of course, heads down with the cops. He tell him, are you going to the Rams football game on Sunday? No. Here, I have two nice tickets for you. There you go. One thing or the other. And by the time they left, they were taking his autograph and delighted to have met him. Okay. Now, at the end of the way, the end of that story is put it as when I put it another way. I asked that sergeant, I said, why do something about it?
Yeah,
and he looked at me. He said, you must be joking me. No one was going to put a hand on Joe, on O.J. Simpson. Yeah. He was too powerful. The people that hung around him were all the Hollywood people, the wealthy people, etc. Yeah. And he once time was convicted. He was taken to court to like going before Judge Judy, you know, the television thing. Yeah. And he got community service that he had to do for 3 weeks. And the community service, he took a few kids out to the golf course, gave them a few clubs in the putting greens and let them, and he went off and playing golf with his buddies. That's as far as it got.
Okay, and I'm very, there's a lot of powerful articles written. The most powerful one I've read today, and I'll tweet it, I don't know whether, when I tweet it, would people be able to access, it's in The Guardian, and it's written by Maura Dunnigan. Very Irish name, written by a fine writer. And I'll just give you the headline, Mike, and it dovetails into what you're saying. O.J. Simpson died a comfortable death in old age that Nicole Brown should have had. The 1994 murders of Simpson's ex and her friend, who's often forgotten about, Ron Goldman, are inextricable from society's failure of domestic abuse victims. Mike Kelleher, Cora Mila Margaret, other abuse victims, Seamus, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Joe? How's it going? You
have a straightforward view about the role of men, or is it just citizens, when they come across other citizens being physically abused?
Well, I would be emphasising on the men. I think men are in a better position to be able to challenge bullies, because that's what it is on public transport. It's generally bullies. I would add to that nobody wants to put themselves in any danger or whatever, but where you have an incident where somebody is actually being verbally or physically abused, men on that train or on that Dart or on that Lewis have an obligation to stand up. But not only that, and this is what makes it powerful, is that not one man, we're not talking about one man, if there's a number of people on that train, and ladies, of course,
I understand that, but Seamus, have you been on a Dart or a Lewis? Which cannot.
Yeah, I've had incidents.
First of all, one, you're trapped in the carriage. Two, you've no knowledge whether other people, men or women, would intervene if you try and intervene. Two, you said the word bullies. That means there's invariably more than one of them in their little gang egging each other on. So you're outnumbered. So maybe your best bet is to turn your back on it.
No, it's not your best bet. The best thing for everyone is for a person to stand up and challenge them in whatever way they can. Now, you can do it in all sorts of ways. You don't have to be totally confrontational. But the important thing is that one person stands up and says, this is not acceptable here. And whatever way he wants to phrase that. Mm-hmm. And that other people then give support. And of course, there's going to be more than one bully, because bullies never operate on their own. And they always pick on somebody this week. And they generally back away.
Yeah, but the Gardaí would say, don't intervene.
Yeah, I know. The Gardaí have to say that. Of course, but you're already, remember what you said, you're already on this Lewis or whatever.
There's no way
of getting, other than pulling the train to a stop. People have to take responsibility on themselves. And my point was, it's just, I think men should never, you should never sit and allow somebody to be abused. There's always something you can do. And just do it. See what happens. You know, the guards have to tell you.
Has it ever happened to you?
Yeah, I've travelled on the Dart for 20 years during my working life. And I had a number of incidents. The worst one was, I remember a nurse coming to help a man who seemed to be having some sort of a fit. Mm-hmm. And the next thing, he socked her in the jaw, knocked her over across the carriageway. And I ended up holding him down until the guards came in a couple of stations later. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but that was an extreme one. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm really talking about young lads who are just getting away with this every single day. And they shouldn't be allowed to get away with it. And we have, it goes back, as I said, you know, citizens' responsibilities. You have to do something. Okay. Anyway, that's my input, Joe.
Okay.
I hope that lady that talked about her experiences, you know, it's an awful way to be thinking in terms of every time she goes on public transport, which she supports, that she's afraid that some sort of an incident like this can happen. So maybe now somebody might just think about this the next time they're on one of those public transports, see something happen, and just stand up and say something.
Okay. Seamus, good to meet him, Hoggard. Seamus, today's programme was produced by Hilary Jones. Ray Darcy is next with the RTE Concert Orchestra.